This is DNAN, the podcast bringing you the latest science and innovation with DNA in our health. Hello and welcome to today's episode on DNA and imprinting. We'll discuss how biochemical tags on our DNA can switch it on or off, and how they're responsible for a group of rare health conditions called imprinting disorders, which occur when the chromosomes forget which parent they came from. So stay tuned to understand how. Hello and welcome to today's episode on DNA and imprinting. We're your hosts, I'm Angelos.
And I'm Hannah. Today we're going to introduce some very new but very cool genetics concepts together with our expert guest speaker, who is Dr. Gavin Kelsey. And Gavin is the head of the epigenetics program at the Babraham Institute in Cambridge. And you're going to hear from him later on in the episode. And these concepts are, drumroll.
It's a virtual drum roll.
Yes, you can't hear it, but we mimed it. And these concepts are epigenetics and imprinting. And these are cool because epigenetics explains how our cells all have different identities despite having the same DNA. For example, becoming a muscle cell versus a skin cell. Well, imprinting explains why we need both a genetic male, sperm, and a genetic female, egg, to make a healthy baby. And why it's not possible for two human males or two human females to do so, despite us having the technology for over 40 years to combine two male genomes or two female genomes. And spoiler number one, imprinting is an epigenetic mechanism, so it ties together. And spoiler number two, scientists have successfully made mice with two dads. So, Angelos,
yep.
What do you think of when you hear the word imprinting?
So when I switch off my genetics brain, isn't imprinting what you say when animals get emotionally attached to you?
Yes, right. But specifically cute baby animals.
Oh, okay.
So we're starting off the episode right with cute baby animals.
So in the land which geneticists live, imprinting means something a bit different, but it's still a similar concept of a memory, but it's memory for DNA this time.
Imprinting is a sort of memory so that DNA remembers if it came from a female egg or a male sperm. So some important background, egg and sperm cells each contain half of our genetic material. But studies in the past have shown that in mammals, combining the DNA from two eggs or from two sperm failed to make viable offspring. We can also see cases of imprinting disorders in humans when both chromosomes from a pair come from the same parent, and this is called uniparental disomy.
So to understand this, we should explain what is epigenetics.
And it's quite convenient, right, that many genetics terms use Greek words, and we have a Greek host. So Angelos, could you please explain what is epigenetics?
Of course I can. So epi in Greek means onto. And genetics means the study of DNA. So epigenetics means the study of what is on the DNA. And we're going to talk about two types of epigenetic modifications. One is directly added onto the DNA molecule, and a second class of epigenetic modification, which is added to the protein that the DNA wraps around.
Yep, and we'll explain this in a minute, don't worry. Actually, you speak Greek. If I spoke Latin, I'd have to learn it first because I don't know. But then we would just speak fluent science, right? Because all the terms are either Greek or Latin.
Yeah, I think we will be the best people to do anatomy.
Anatomy?
Like, yeah, exactly. Because I have the terms are Latin
but
and
I
the
like
other
genetics
half are
too much. No, I can never leave genetics. I'm too much of a fan. Anyway, it's my favorite time. So it's time for an analogy. So there are different types of epigenetic modifications, right? But the most stable is the first one you mentioned, which is added directly to the DNA, called DNA methylation. Okay, so break it down. Technically, it's a biochemical modification with a complicated chemical name, but it's called methylation since it involves adding a methyl group, which is a carbon and three hydrogens.
This is specifically added to the letter C. Remember how we talked about the A, C, T, and G, which are the four letters of the DNA language? And DNA methylation occurs specifically on the C, the cytosine. And for the fans of chemistry in the audience, this is on the fifth carbon of the cytosine.
Now, we can think of it as, post-it notes, which mm-hmm. is stuck to yeah. some of the C letters in the DNA. So we've used the analogy before of our DNA being a library. So imagine if you're in the nucleus of a muscle cell. So you're in that DNA library, your genome, and someone's gone and stuck red post-it notes over all the books for skin, liver, kidney, etc. So the only books left without the post-it notes are the muscle ones. And that's how the cell knows its identity as a muscle cell.
But DNA methylation is quite stable. So maybe not a post-it note, because you can always remove the post-it note. Maybe like a padlock, so the book is locked closed, or glue that maybe sticks the pages together so you can read them.
Yeah, yeah, actually, I think that's better. We'll go with that.
Great analogy once again.
Great analogy.
So yeah, the second type of epigenetic modifications are called histone modifications. So you may have heard the numbers that each cell has 2 meters of DNA. And if stretched out, that's 6.5 feet. And that's all packaged into the nucleus of a cell, which is over 100,000 times smaller.
It's crazy, right? So it's going to have to be packaged very tightly. And it's thanks to these proteins, which are called histones. So, okay, analogy. This one is quite easy. So you can just think of something that wraps around something else. So, I don't know, like toilet paper?
To toilet paper?
But hear me out, right? So the cardboard tube would be the histone protein, and the toilet paper would be the DNA that wraps around it. Although DNA actually wraps around histone, I think, between 1 and 2 turns. So not as mm-hmm. many as toilet paper.
Yeah, or it would be the worst toilet paper. Very impractical.
Yeah, 1.5 sheets.
So yeah, toilet paper analogy would have been good in the COVID-19 episode, because remember all the people who were hoarding toilet paper?
Yes. Oh, a bit late with that one.
Anyway, because everyone was doing that, but...
Not us. Not us at DNA.
Another analogy that I thought about was maybe like a film reel. So I'm a huge film nerd, so you have to excuse me for that. But maybe if you think like genes as the scenes of a movie, and the reel is like the whole genome. So to find a specific gene, you need to unwrap that reel mm-hmm. and you're like, oh, here it is.
Yeah. I like that. I laughed for a second when you said, oh, I'm a huge fan of film, so forgive me. Because I thought, does that make me a huge fan of toilet paper? is that why I picked that analogy? Anyway, we can move on. So these histone modifications are better described as post-it notes, I think, actually, because they're a bit more dynamic, aren't they, than the DNA methylation, and they can change more often. So practically, these histone modifications cause the histone DNA complex to either become packed up really tightly, so it's very dense and it's inaccessible to the cellular machinery. And this is what we mean when we say it's the switched off state. Or they can cause the histone DNA to open up and become looser and more accessible, and we call that the switched on. And for a last technical tidbit, so this is because the chemical one of the reasons is because the chemical modifications are either positively or negatively charged, so they either attract towards each other or repel and open up.
Nice. So now we have a background in epigenetics, and we can tell you more about genetic imprinting next and share some insight from an expert in the field. Okay, so imprinting, which is the focus of today's episode, is an epigenetic mechanism, as we said. So this is something that works through chemical modifications on the DNA molecule or at the histone proteins that it's wrapped around. The role of these modifications is specifically to help the chromosomes remember their parental origin.
Yes, so some important background to help everyone understand this is that we have 2 sets of chromosomes, one from mum and one from dad. And the imprinted regions, there's only 20 of them, so it's not many, right? The genome's very large. But at these 20 regions, the chemical tags will be different from the moment of conception.
Nice. So the 20 or so imprinted regions in our DNA, they exist, like all our DNA, as 2 copies. One from the chromosome from mom and one of the chromosome from dad. But despite having the same DNA sequence and the same position on the chromosome, they have different epigenetic marks. In other words, their padlocks lock 1 copy and unlock the other.
Exactly. And each imprinted region have their own defined pattern of lock versus unlock for mum versus dad on the DNA or vice versa. And that's the same for all humans. So this seems like a good time to get an expert opinion. So we asked Dr. Gavin Kelsey to tell us more about these imprinted regions and why they're so special.
In general, epigenetic marks are wiped clean between generations, and this is important to avoid epigenetic alterations that might have resulted from adverse environments, such as poor diet, from being passed from parent to offspring, This occurs in a series of cleansing and rewriting steps, first in the precursor cells of the sperm and the egg, then during development of the gametes, and again very soon after fertilization. As a result of these cleansing steps, most of the genome, epigenetically speaking, has no memory of whether it came from mum or dad. Imprinted genes are an exception because they do retain the epigenetic tags that were added in the egg or the sperm.
So why is this imprinting specific to 20 locations in the genome, and why does it not happen everywhere?
These 20 or so regions, called imprinting control regions, are very important because they cause the imprinting of about 20 genes in their vicinity, corresponding to about 1% of our genome. These regions are special because they have docking sites for one or two proteins that bring in the machinery that ensures DNA methylation is reinstated at these sites every time the DNA is replicated. And critically, they do this in the very early embryo when the rest of the genome is being more or less stripped of its DNA methylation. So they make sure those molecular padlocks remain in place.
Wow. And when you think about it, so all this information is maintained through unlimited cell divisions, which is pretty cool. So every cell in our body came from another cell, which divided from one cell into two. So the new cell also copies the DNA methylation. So it keeps those signals which say lock, unlock.
And we like to focus on healthcare in DNA end, and the disruptions to these epigenetic tags at imprinted regions can cause rare health conditions. We currently know of 13 rare health conditions, which we call imprinting disorders, which occur due to changes at these imprinted regions on the DNA. So we should give an example. So there is a region towards the end of chromosome 11 where there are two imprinting control regions, resulting in a bunch of genes which are active only on the mother's chromosome and some genes which are only active in the father's chromosome. Mutations in this region cause two so-called mirror syndromes.
Oh yeah, I know these. So chromosome 11, that one's the Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome and Silver-Russell syndrome, right?
Do you want to explain why they're called mirror syndromes?
Yes, so they're called mirror syndromes because the classical symptoms are the opposite. Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome is characterized by overgrowth, while Silver-Russell syndrome is characterized by undergrowth.
Yeah, this is so interesting because the conditions have almost opposite symptoms. And the major cause is a gene called IGF-2, which encodes a growth factor, but it's only active on the father's chromosome. So it's analogy time. So on chromosome 11, around this growth factor gene, the mother's chromosome has lots of padlocks. So it's off. If a mutation occurs which removes those padlocks, then you have two active books and twice as much activity as you want.
Or if the mutation happens on the father's chromosome, which was the active one, so it didn't have any padlocks, then you would end up with the mother's chromosome being inactive due to the padlocks and the father's chromosome being inactive due to a mutation. So you would get no activity.
Okay, so epigenetic marks are usually removed and the DNA is wiped clean of its memory in the sperm and the eggs, except for these specific locations.
Exactly, but why? This is what blows my mind. Why does this happen? What benefit is there? And how did this mechanism evolve? So here's Dr. Gavin Kelsey to explain.
There have been arguments about why genetic imprinting exists in mammals for as long as we've known about the phenomenon. The paradox is that if it is generally good to have two copies of a gene so as to provide a backup in case of a mutation, what advantage would there be in deliberately silencing one copy and sacrificing this insurance? The most developed theory is often called the parental conflict hypothesis. It recognized that paternal imprinted genes tend to promote growth of the fetus, while maternal imprinted genes tend to restrain fetal growth. According to this theory, father's genes can be considered more selfish as they are interested in maximizing the life chances of the current fetus without much regard for future offspring from the same female. Whereas mother's genes are more interested in maximizing the output of fit offspring across the whole reproductive life of that female. This is particularly the case in mammals because of placentation. Females invest huge resources into the development and growth of offspring. Paternal genes operating in the fetus or placenta have the opportunity to subvert this investment and extract extra resources from mum.
Okay, so this makes a lot of sense, right? Thinking in evolutionary terms, a female with more children would pass on more of her DNA. So it's in her interest to have more pregnancies and to limit the resources spent on each one. Whereas a male is in their interest for their one offspring to survive, so they want them to grow bigger and outcompete the others. So the female genes have to come in and even things out.
Thank God, because all the babies would be gene bros.
Gene bros. New technical term.
All very fascinating. So that gives us some background on why imprinted genes exist. Before we move to the next part of the episode, we asked Dr. Kelsey one final question. What gets you excited when thinking about the future of imprinting research?
Imprinting has been a fascinating topic because it has told us so much about how genes are regulated epigenetically, and it really has become a paradigm for this process. It has motivated research into how epigenetic information is remodeled at the very start of life and raised questions about evolutionary strategies of gene control. Of course, there are still unanswered questions, such as how is silencing enforced over multiple genes in imprinted domains? Are there alternative forms of imprinting that rely on different epigenetic tags other than DNA methylation? We know this is the case in mice, but is it more widespread? And imprinted genes provide really important quality control signals in applications such as assisted reproduction or for the development of artificial gametes in the culture dish.
Talking about mice, so we promised to share the story of the mice with two dads. But okay, quick side note. When I was researching this episode, I was reading about, and this will sound really random, but just bear with me. When you breed a male donkey with a female horse, you get a mule. But when you breed a female donkey with a male horse, you get a hinny. And they're actually quite different. So in terms of their size is different, their ears are different lengths, and their temperaments are also quite different.
Oh, wait a minute. I was discussing this the other day with some friends, and they asked me what is the difference when you breed a female donkey or a male donkey and so on. And I didn't know the answer, and I actually know. I think it started with ligers and tigons and all of that.
Oh, that's next. That's next.
I know, but it's like I didn't know, and I suddenly became the audience of my own podcast. How's that possible?
Okay, you're going to know now. Okay, we've just got a bit of an insight into what Angelos talks to his friends about. But anyway, so it's because of imprinting. So lions and tigers, a male lion and a female tiger make a liger, but the other way around, and it's called a tigon. So this is because of imprinting. If you've got imprinting at different positions, then you might be getting twice the expected amount of proteins or none, depending on which parent is which. So interestingly, the female tiger and the male lion offspring, which is the liger, a liger is the biggest of all of the big cats, so bigger than the lion and bigger than the tiger. And the theory is because tigers are generally more solitary, there's less competition for the offspring of the male tigers. So the male tigers didn't evolve the imprinted genes for their offspring to grow larger, and therefore the female tigers didn't need to evolve the imprinted genes to reduce the growth of the offspring. So the ligers are getting twice the amount of the growth factors, so they get bigger.
Ah.
So it's different combinations of imprinted genes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I've become the audience of the podcast. This is so helpful.
I'm so glad. I was thinking when I put this in, I was like, this is totally random, but it's also quite interesting.
Well, not to my friends, Hannah.
Not that random. Okay.
All right. Let's talk about the mouse.
Yes. Let's talk about the mouse with the two dads.
So this was a huge scientific milestone achieved by the group of Professor Hayashi based in Osaka University in Japan. Although there are a few different groups working on this.
Did you know that he was named in Time magazine's 100 most influential people this year?
Yeah, it's so nice to see scientists there. Now we have something to aim for. But honestly, it's well deserved. Really, most people thought it was impossible for mammals of the same genetic sex to have a viable and fertile offspring. But a couple of studies now have demonstrated that it is, in fact, possible with limitations, which we're going to discuss.
Yeah, and there's lots of implications here, right? If we can indeed help mammals to have fertile offspring from parents of the same genetic sex, can the methods be used to, for example, save endangered species? So the northern white rhinoceros actually only has two females left in the world. So this technique could be very important. Or to help individuals with disorders of sex chromosomes to have children or even same-sex couples. But we do need to hold back on our excitement and talk about the science. So this is research and there are a lot of limitations. It's very unlikely that this will apply to humans in our lifetime, would be my guess.
Exactly. So there was a paper in 2018 where researchers in Beijing made a fertile mice with two moms by deleting three imprinted regions on the DNA from one of the females. But this recent paper took a different approach and successfully created fertile mice with two dads.
Yeah, and this is really interesting. So if we break it down, the research group were able to take skin cells from male mice and program them into what we call pseudo-female eggs.
Yep, and we will unpack this a bit for our listeners. This is, of course, acknowledging all of the previous work in the field that has led to this discovery. So we will link some of the reading materials in the show notes and our website in case you want to read more about it. So this study did a lot of genetic manipulation. Believe it or not, it's not straightforward to hack biology. Who would have thought? But these days we have a lot of knowledge about how cells develop from an embryo to an adult. So scientists can control cellular identity.
It's basically a case of exposing cells in a dish to specific chemical signals and manipulating the environment in which the cells are grown in. You can think of it like giving the cells a specific cocktail, which can change their identity.
Yep. They first turned skin cells into a blank slate. The technical term is pluripotent, with one of these cocktails. Then they needed the XY male cell to become an XX female cell.
Yes, and here's the neat trick. So they grew these cells in a dish, and around 6% of them just spontaneously lost the Y chromosome. And because it's super small, it sometimes does that. So they were no longer the male XY, they were just X.
They waited, with the help of another cocktail, for the cells to randomly duplicate the solo X chromosome to complete the pair.
Yeah, and these cells are now genetically female, having previously been genetically male.
Yep, and then they used another cocktail, which encourages the cells to develop into and identify as egg cells. This could be the eggnog cocktail.
Yes, that's a good one for the menu.
Hannah wrote this joke for me.
No, don't call me out. I thought it was really funny.
No, I liked it. It's just that it was strange because I was not expecting to make a joke and suddenly I had a joke to make. But I like it. Let's keep it like okay. This.
Thank you. Okay, so they had the eggnog cocktail and it worked. So there were two X chromosomes.
Yeah, and then they fertilized the egg cells with sperm from another male mouse and it worked.
We should clarify some key notes. So one, this is not a perfect process. The success rate was actually only around 1%. I mean, any success in something like this is incredible. But if your question is, could this work in humans? I mean, one, we don't really want to be impregnating females with a technique that has a 99% failure rate. But two, there could be some unwanted consequences from having two identical X chromosomes. For example, if there happens to be a disease-causing mutation on one, if you duplicate it, then you've got two copies with that. So you'd need to consider that too.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, this still involved growing cells in a dish and making them into man-made egg cells, which is a very new and unproven method in humans.
Yeah, and this process currently relies on the cells dividing multiple times and like the perfect error happening, which is what you want. So you'd need to be 100% sure that other errors haven't occurred as well. And another random thought, I wonder if the successful cells are those which are more prone to errors. So for example, if their own internal DNA repair mechanisms don't work as well, so they're more likely to have errors. So there might be like a natural selection for cells which have poor error correction, and we want to avoid that. Anyway, we're going into scientist mode now. And we can't because we got to wrap up the episode.
Just one comment. If that is true, it would be unnatural selection because it would come from us in a way.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah, anyway. Blurry lines, very grey.
All right. But anyway, what a cool study and a nice topic to talk about. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, but yes, this is sadly all we have time for.
Oh, we should get one of those sound desks when you can press a button and then you hear like the sound of the audience going, ah, or applauding.
Yeah. Look, honestly, the applause could be for our exciting upcoming episodes. You can look forward to our episode on gene therapy, where we discuss possible therapies and clinical trials for treatments of rare genetic diseases.
Yes, and we didn't have time to cover that today, but there is research ongoing into potential therapies for imprinting disorders. For example, if someone has a genetic variant which disrupts the copy, which is normally the unlocked one, can we target the copy which is locked and change the epigenetic modifications to unlock it, and then you can restore one functional copy? Anyway, you can look forward to that in our gene therapy episode. But first, a big thank you to our guest speaker, Dr. Gavin Kelsey. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on Spotify or whatever platform you get your podcasts, or send us a message on X or your favorite social media platform. We should be on it at DNA and Pod. And check the episode description because we are announcing there the winner of our book giveaway. And this one is very on brand. The lucky winner will receive a copy of an amazing book by Nessa Carey called The Epigenetics Revolution.
And a final thanks to the UK Genetic Society and Society for Endocrinology for supporting this podcast. See you in the next episode.
Is it see you? I always, yeah, I don't know, hear you?
Not even hear you. You hear us.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to think of a new outro.
Sorry for that. Yeah. All right. Cheers. I don't know. That is quite.
Bye.
Bye.